Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by Johns Hopkins Medicine. For the 19th consecutive year, the Johns Hopkins Hospital is ranked number one by U.S. News and World Report in their annual Best Hospital Survey. Find out more about the nation's top hospital at hopkinsmedicine.org. We're talking food. This is one of our Urbanite radio stories. It was inspired, my producer, Justin Levy. It was inspired by the prodigal pepper. On the trail of the fish pepper, Baltimore's historical hot stuff, which is a piece of food coming out of the African-American world in our community that most people never heard of. An article was written, inspired a whole story here on today's show about local food and cuisine and growing and more. And a book that we used to prepare for the show belonged to one of our guests. It's called Renewing America's Food Traditions, Saving and Savoring the Continent's Most Endangered Foods. And they divide the world of food up in America into these 13 different food nations we have in America, from Acorn Nation, Bison Nation, Chestnut Nation, Chili Pepper Nation, Clambake Nation, Cornbread Nation, I want to live there, Crab Cake Nation, Gumbo Nation, I want to live there too, Maple Syrup Nation, Moose Nation, Pinion Nut Nation, Salmon Nation, and Wild Rice Nation. So we are somewhere between we are in the Crab Cake Nation, at least part of it, and we're in some other places as well in the state of Maryland. We want you to join us here with your thoughts about local cuisine, gardening, and the history of all that at 410-319-8888. Scott Carlson wrote the article, The Prodigal Pepper. He's co-founder of the Rogers Forge Farm Initiative and farms in his front lawn and is back in the studio again. Scott, good to see you.
Good to see you, Mark.
Mike Kipp is here, who I haven't seen in a while back. He's Mick. Owner of Whiskey Island. Mick, good to see you, man.
Back at you, Mark.
And Alexia Sevold, did I say that right?
You did.
Is with us. She's horticulturist for the Akakik Foundation. And a man who's got many talents is with us here on the show, Michael Twitty, who's a culinary historian and has studied the food culture of slaves and the descendants in this region and around the country and more. And Michael Twitty, good to meet you. Good to have you in the studio.
Hello and happy Shavuos.
Happy Shavuos to you, too. It is Shavuos. It is Shavuos. The Festival of Weeks is upon us. And the number here is 410-319-8888. Let me turn to you, Scott. To start us off with this story of this pepper and why you have written this piece in the first place.
Well, I knew Mick from a story that I had done about him and the sun a couple of years ago, and I knew that Mick was crazy about peppers just generally, hot peppers generally.
Yes.
And I'd actually come across this book a little while ago, this Renewing America's Food Traditions.
Great book. I love this book.
Which was written by Gary Paul Nabhan, who's now at the University of Arizona, and he's well known as a person who's documenting traditional foods in American culture and really around the world. And what he does with this book is he looks at what are the traditional foods, what are the traditional varieties of foods that you find in America, and what's happening to those foods. And really, it's in a way a sad story, because what's happening to a lot of foods of those foods is that they're disappearing. Just to give you an example, something I read recently, at the turn of the century, 1900, we had 7,000 varieties of apples in this country. Today, 6,000 of those 7,000 are gone.
And gone, literally, no seeds left, no genetic material left, nothing.
They're essentially extinct, yeah. Yeah. To give you another example, potatoes, worldwide, there's more than 5,000 varieties that are grown worldwide. But commercially, there's only 4 varieties that are generally grown.
In this country or around the world.
Around the world,
And we are the continents where the potato began.
Yeah. Yes, that is absolutely true. And the reason why this is a problem is because it leads to this sort of monoculture problem in agriculture. And what that means is that when you're growing one particular variety of plant, you're susceptible to all the diseases that might hit that plant. If you're if you have one thing, one genetically distinct thing, that thing is going to be more susceptible to, say, a rust or a virus or some type of leaf blight than you would have if you were growing a bunch of different varieties, because you would have more genetic diversity there. And so as we head into the future, where we're going to face a number of challenges related to water, related to biodiversity, related to climate change and soil erosion and so on, we need the kind of genetic diversity to be able to breed plants that will withstand these kinds of problems.
So, and so take us to this pepper, though.
Well, the pepper, Actually, Mick might be better at describing the history of the pepper.
Me, I think this guy here, Michael. Scott introduced me to the book, and I make a line of hot sauces and spicy and specialty foods here in town. And my whole concern was always to get the freshest peppers possible. Not necessarily if they were organic, if they were all natural, but to get the freshest peppers possible that had a lot of flavor. And over the course of my education the last few years, learning stuff from Scott and other gardeners in the city, I learned more about organic, and then striking up a relationship with Joan Norman, who with her husband Drew own One Straw Farm, learning how to grow peppers without pesticides or plants in general. So when Scott gave me this book, I thought, oh my God, the fish pepper. Well, yeah, people can grow it in their garden, but what if we could grow it massively again? Properly, because I've learned to become better with picking the types of peppers or produce that I use when I make my specialty foods, and I want to pass that on to others. And so for me, that is how I came to the fish pepper and how I learned more about the fish pepper as far as its history. From what I understand, it was brought to this country through the slave trade somewhere in the 1820s, 1850s time frame of the 1800s. It had its heyday in the 1900s and 1920s, 30s, used in the oyster and crab houses around the Chesapeake Bay, and I would assume the Delaware Bay also, because it has such an influence in the Philadelphia, D.C., as well as Baltimore market. Over the course of time, with the oyster houses and crab houses slowly disappearing, the need for the pepper, the need for growing the pepper, kind of disappeared also, to where when we got to the late 70s, early 80s, it became not in essence extinct, but definitely endangered, to where you didn't see it anywhere.
And the reason why the pepper was connected to the fish cream sauces was because it's unique in the sense that it grows white, and so that you can put it into these cream sauces and it sort of disappears.
And the chefs like the producers
blends right in.
Yeah. Like
there's an alternative history, however. You know, when you read the seed catalogs and William Moyes Weaver, they started off at 1870. Well, that's almost impossible for it to be an African-American heirloom starting in 1870. What you find out a lot about plants that are endemic, shall we say, to enslaved communities is that they're pretty much being coveted.
What do you mean they're being coveted?
Coveted in the sense of the community is keeping guard over its own production. Because the rule in slavery for a truck patch or a huck patch, which is where a provision ground, which some enslaved people were allowed to keep, was your stuff can't be my stuff, meaning the slave owner to enslaved people. So if you grow the same stuff as me, how do I know you're not taking from me?
Mm-hmm. So they had to grow. So slaves had to grow different things in their patches.
Yes, and they grew things that were familiar to them. For example, going back to the late 1700s in North Carolina, in eastern North Carolina, a group of enslaved Africans was brought directly from West Africa to North Carolina. Within a year of their arrival, the slaveholder, Josiah Collins, one of the largest slaveholders in North Carolina history, had to purchase 1,000 hot peppers to feed his enslaved workforce. So they were determining, they were telling him, we're going to eat this way. And you can imagine that those pepper seeds get planted and become, you know, part of the gardens. As far as the fish pepper is concerned, that I'm going to amend Mick's story just a tiny bit and say that, you know, remember the slave trade in Maryland stopped in the mid-1700s. So that means there's a long time where people are not coming in from West Africa, but there are also people who are being smuggled in, and there are people coming from the Caribbean. The Caribbean is the bounce-off region for all African crops, for okra, for peanuts, for other things. In the 1790s to the 1820s, Haitians, Jamaicans, Barbadians will come to the Chesapeake region, and they will bring plants that they've been growing in the Afro-Caribbean provision grounds for centuries. So the fish pepper could be something that comes from West Africa, or it could be something that comes from the Caribbean. But I guarantee you, as Mick pointed out, it's daggone sure earlier than 1870. And it's probably being produced for these catering businesses that African-Americans owned in Philadelphia and Baltimore.
But, I mean, historically, though, peppers were from here.
Yes.
And they were brought by Columbus and the rest, and they became African and Indian.
Sort of. This is how it goes. The pepper comes from South America. The Portuguese bring it to West Africa.
Right.
It's more of a preservative and a medicine than it is a spice. West Africans happen upon it. There are all sorts of native peppers, including the grains of paradise, malagueta pepper. They call alligator pepper in the African community. That's the leading pepper. But all these native peppers are hot, but they're not chili peppers. Once a chili pepper starts, Africans call them bird peppers because the birds eat them, they chew them, they do their thing, and they spread, and they diversify. And people don't realize this, but all these plants don't come to Africa and stop diversification. Africans took plantains and bananas, took one or two varieties, and turned them into several hundred varieties. More variety of plantains and bananas than there are in Asia, where the plantain and banana started. So you can imagine what happens to peanuts, to peppers, other things. So yeah, it becomes a staple of the diet. If you go to Central Africa, it's called piri piri. If you go to West Africa, they have suya. So there's all these different pepper rubs and mixes that you find long before, and pepper sauces. And one of the things I read from the 1600s says that the West Africans, says the Africans always put pepper in everything they eat. So it's a hot diet. That's how the Europeans describe it.
And let me introduce in this conversation Alexia Settled.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Leap in. Don't be shy here.
Well, I've been growing fish pepper for a few years.
That's a fish pepper we're looking at?
Yeah, this is a fish pepper. It has wonderful green and white leaves, and the peppers, when they emerge, are green and white striped. And as they become ripe, they kind of have a reddish stripe to them.
And these are really on that, what is it called, the scaffold scale?
Scoville scale.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome.
I didn't know, but I knew you would know, Mick. So the Scoville scale, these are really hot on
They're
that
hot.
Scale.
Not as hot as habaneros, but
like a Serrano.
A Serrano.
About.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, cayenne to Serrano. If you look at your heat scale of 0 to 10, with a habanero being a 10, a jalapeno being a 3, this will come in at about a 7.
That's hot.
It's on the upper echelon of the
so
of
have
the
you
heat.
Eaten one?
Yeah.
And?
They're great. I usually cook them up. Don't eat them raw.
So this is a pepper that is kind of was forgotten that you all are reintroducing.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think Michael planted the seed. No pun intended, for me to start growing this, because he's worked with the Akiki Foundation before, and yeah, it's been great having it around. It's a great conversation piece.
So, I mean, so the Akiki Foundation is actually growing old foods, is that what you do?
Yeah, I focus mostly on heirlooms, and we also have an 18th century colonial site, so we try to grow varieties that the colonists would have grown in the 18th century.
As in?
Virginia Gordstein corn, certain varieties of okra, cotton, wheat, red May wheat specifically, certain varieties of different brassicas, cabbage, those sorts of things.
Folks, it's your turn to join us here at 410-319-8888. We're talking about the foods that were originally our foods centuries ago. We've lost a great deal of them. We have an incredible panel here. This is one of our Urbanite radio stories. Scott Carlson, who we brought here before, was because he turned his front lawn into an edible garden, which is
it's a good awesome follow-up garden. On that. I should get
the truck patch.
The truck patch. And wrote the article Prodigal Pepper in this month's Urbanite. Mick Kipp is famous in this town for Whiskey Island and the incredible hot spices and stuff that he creates. Mm-hmm. Alexia Settled is a horticulturist for the Akakik Foundation, preserving and creating our ancient food. And Michael Twitty is a culinary historian who really knows more than most people I've ever met about this kind of stuff or heard of, and has studied food culture of American slaves and their descendants, not just in this region, but around the country, and is much more than that. And so join us here at 410-319-8888. Maybe your family were truck farmers, and a lot of African Americans in this community. When I was a kid, truck farmers were huge back in the 50s and early 60s. They were everywhere across the state of Maryland. Mm-hmm. Farmers had these small patches of land, and a lot of them were black folks so a lot of the agriculture that came out of that came out of the black community. And join us here at 410-319-8888. I actually live in an area now. Valerie and I live in a place now that there is a couple of really old black communities where the truck farms flourished out by Sparks and other places. And that's where they were, 410-319-8888. Because we lost a lot, Michael Twitty, in this, the loss of that African-American agricultural community we had in this area.
Yeah, it's interesting that, you know, Lexi and I are old buddies, and one of the things that I have to give her a lot of credit for is trying to revamp some of these efforts. I mean, if you ever make it out to her garden, Akakik Foundation, and they have an African-American festival they hold in the fall, in September this year, I believe September 25th this year. Yeah. And, you know, you can see what those gardens look like. They were not little, you know, nice road gardens. They were, you know how we talk about the Native Americans and Three Sisters?
Yes, right.
Well, Africans had
No, why don't you step back?
Yeah.
Because most people don't know what Three Sisters
are. Okay, Three Sisters, corn, beans, and squash growing together.
As one.
Working together as one, being, you know, sort of, what's the word we use in biology? When animals.
Symbiotic.
Symbiotic relationship. There you go. So that's what, you know, West Africans had, Central Africans had the same thing, just different plants. But, as you know, you're mimicking the natural system as opposed to working against it. You know, nature has no rows.
Right.
Not really. and no perfect circles either. But you can see that Alexia has lived in West Africa. So
really?
She brought some of that knowledge back. And, I mean, she's done a trip that a lot of us black folks have not made yet. You know, she's found her Kunta Kinte. But that having been said, you know, I think it's a big deal because we were, you know, some of the primary caterers. We were the chicken merchants. I mean, that sounds like a joke, but it's the truth. Chickens were low-class animals. So the low-class people took care of them.
That's why slaves had them.
That's right. And they were the ones who sold them to their owners and to people in the market. I forgot to mention this. In between Barbara Cerruti, I have to give her full credit for this fact because she dug it up.
From the American Humanities Council?
Yes. Uh-huh. She told me something so exciting. She said that between the late 1700s and 1820, the Haitians who were refugees or the slaves of people who were coming from Santo Domingo basically came here and did what any good immigrant community does. They find a niche that's being, you know, has a vacuum, and they do their best to monopolize it. The Haitian community controlled the produce market here in Baltimore for 20 years.
Back then?
Back then, in antebellum times. They ran it. They were the ones who were doing it. So of course, some of these things that they're bringing from Haiti, tomatoes, peppers, okras, are going to be in that market, are going to be grown. But the bottom line is, you know, you have the tremendous history of truck farming and on the eastern shore, around Baltimore, around Washington, southern Maryland. Why are some of these things hidden? We don't know about them as much. Like I said earlier, it was an issue of coveting or making sure your community had full ownership and control of its products, of its produce. And there's something very interesting about it, too. You know, fish pepper is only as hot as the person who grows it. Okay? In West African culture, it all goes back to that. I don't care what anybody says. Whether people, you know, nobody had to tell you about Vodun. You understand what I'm saying? The traditional religion. It just kind of perpetuated itself. And one of the things is that a person, okay, Scott, what's the name? Okay, you're good with words today. I'm barely bad with words today. I usually love words. What's the word for when we have a relationship between us and nature, and we're like feeding off of each other, and there's energy? And, you know, between us and the pepper, if I have a hot nature, you see what I'm saying? The pepper will be hot. So don't ever get a fish pepper from somebody who's not angry. I don't trust Alexia's peppers.
I've heard that. I've read that before. Right?
Because she's not an angry person.
You to make a pepper hot, you have to be angry when you plant it.
Exactly. See, the spirits are already in here.
They did. I'm down there, but I'm back up.
You know, my grandmother used to say, she said, and I'll keep this one clean, she used to say, peppers for the menfolk. So keep that in mind, those of us who are over 40.
Join us here at 410-319-8888. We want to hear your thoughts about what we're talking about, which is our food and where it comes from and the history of your own families and what you made and cooked and what your grandmothers and grandfathers and great-grandparents talked about. And 410-319-8888 with our guests. There's a question came in at steinershow.org. You can write there, too, and ask your questions. It says, hi, Mark, you mentioned at the beginning of the show that one of your guests is part of a Rogers Forge farm group. Can he tell us what that is? Thanks, Chris, in Rogers Forge.
Well, the Rogers Forge Farm Initiative is what a neighbor and I have put together. And what it is a group that we have gotten together, a group of neighbors that have gotten together to promote gardening in yards to help promote this kind of victory gardening that was more common maybe in an earlier era.
World War II, World War One.
Yes. And, as you know, I was on the show before because I took my front yard and I put a big garden, and a vegetable garden, in the front yard. And if Michael was talking about messy gardens, I think this is what the neighbors might have been angry about. But I got into some trouble because the community association sent me a letter saying that front yards were not meant for vegetable gardens.
I've
ignored them. In fact, I was elected to the very board that sent me to the letter of complaint. So, but anyway, it's meant to encourage people in our neighborhood, this largely middle class neighborhood, to get outside, to work the land, to have a little patch somewhere in the yard where they're growing things, and to recognize some of these plants again. I mean, what we found with some people, at least in the neighborhood, is that they don't know what lettuce looks like when it's coming out of the ground. I mean, we're so distanced from the production of these things that sustain us. It's a little bit scary.
410-319-8888. Get to these calls in a minute coming in. I have to turn to you as we expand this conversation. I want to talk about how we renew America's foods and what do we do about that, and what you all are thinking about how we do about that, in all your, whether it's in your business or your farming or your experiments. But tell us a bit before we get to the first caller here. And Fran, hold on, because I'm going to ask Alexia, tell us about your experience in West Africa. You did what there?
I was a Peace Corps volunteer in the Gambia.
In the Gambia?
Mm-hmm. I was an agroforestry volunteer, so I lived in a rural village with no electricity or running water for 2 years and gardened and farmed with the people.
And what did you learn about that from them?
I learned a lot.
I mean, you were there to teach, but you probably learned more than you taught, didn't
you? Yeah, I definitely learned a lot more than I taught. I hung out with the women all the time, so I just, you know, basically lived their lives.
Smart move, buddy.
Yeah, and, you know, pounded the millet with them, went to the rice fields, gardened. The women garden and the men farm, so they're very, very separate culture. But the men build the fences for the gardens, so there was a little breakdown in communication in order to have fences for your gardens. You had to talk to the men to make it happen. But we grew vegetables, we played with the babies, we, you know, did the laundry together. It was a great experience. I learned so much.
410-319-8888 and Fran in Maryland, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi, Fran.
Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm glad you're having this show today on this, because many years ago, I was at one of those Soho eateries down in Washington, D.C., where everybody cavalcaded around. And they had a salad bar there, and they had these very long Welch's grape juice colored peppers, and they weren't exactly dry, but they were very flat and they were kind of crinkly, and it was kind of a black Welch's grape juice color of that pepper, and I bit into that, and I immediately, my eyes watered, my mouth salivated. It really scared the hell out of me, and I went to the bathroom. And I had to get water, wash my mouth out for about literally 5 minutes with water. And then I went back to the table, and, of course, nobody knew anybody, but this woman, she was either, I think, Russian or Czechoslovakian. She had a little mini salad. She goes, here, you eat, because she could tell I was having some kind of reaction. So I ate her salad, and it was better, so... Was that either an allergic reaction, or was that normal for that type of pepper to be? Was that how hot that pepper was reaction, or could you help me out with that?
I can a little.
Go right ahead.
When you were describing the pepper, it didn't sound like anything I knew until you said the reaction you had, and that is a reaction that you get when you either eat a chocolate Trinidad Congo or a red Trinidad Congo or a yellow Trinidad Congo. They fall into the habanero family of peppers, which are the hottest of the peppers. But the Trinidad Congo peppers, in my opinion, are the hottest. And you bite into one of those and you think you're going to die. And the sauces that you'll find from Trinidad combine all four or five of these different color peppers. And that purple pepper would be a purple Congo. The way you described it being flat and long, I've never seen them that way. But the reaction you had says that's what it was, if that helps you out.
That sounds pretty
scary.
And
those are the type of peppers also that if you're cooking them in your house and you're not wearing gloves
and you rub any part of your body.
Well, exactly, if you're a guy. But if you rub any part of your body, and especially around the face,
yes,
the burn around your eyes is awful. You will hate it. It's awful. So always wear gloves.
Fran, thanks for the call. I'm glad we could help out. Not me, but I'm glad our guests could help out. I mean, you have to be really careful with peppers. You're not supposed to bite into a hot pepper.
Mm-mm.
I mean, that's something you cut up finely and cook in your food.
They were used as punishment in every culture that's ever adopted peppers.
Punishment?
And the Aztecs, of course, in the Aztecs, Mayans, Incas, all of whom had some variety of pepper. They were the original cultivators of them, would use them as punishment for everything with their children. So, for example, if a child stole, they rubbed it on parts of their body would be very uncomfortable. If a child backtalked, they would take the peppers and put them in the fire where they're drying the peppers, mm-hmm. put the child's eyes over the fire, their little pictographs of this happening. The parents punishing the children's way in West Africa, the same deal. I rub this into your skin so you won't do something again. Southeast Asia, the same deal. They use this form of punishment, social control, as well as a flavoring agent. And I wanted to, jump on what Mick said. And notice he said the Trinidad Congo pepper. See, even then, it's that you can hear the origins of some of these peppers, or at least the cultural origins. I know in Trinidad they have a lot of people from Central Africa, from Congo, Angola. Mm-hmm. And so even saying that, lets you know where these things are coming from.
Right. And I think because that's one of the things that I think we gets lost in our history too, is the food brought over in all kinds of manner,
mm-hmm.
hidden away by people who were captured in Africa and brought here as slaves to the Western Hemisphere. I mean, food came with them, and I think we don't think about that very much.
Mm-mm.
That we think of everything was kind of given, but this is a lot of stuff came and remained in slave culture.
Cultural baggage. Cultural luggage. And a lot of the times it comes over not so much under, but on top of them. Because the idea was, let's keep these captives, I won't say people in this context because they weren't considered people, pacified. We'll give the Igbo from Nigeria yams. We'll give the Gambians rice. We'll give the Congolese cassava. And then we're going to make something called slabber sauce. Now, this is where your peppers probably came over. Because they would give them this garbage, this swill on the ship called slabber sauce. Slabber sauce was whatever starch that group had, plus palm oil, which was the general, the butter, the olive oil of tropical West Africa, plus peppers. And you had to eat this stuff, dirt and all, on the slave ship over, and beans usually added to it. So in order to have more slabber sauce, when they first came over, I'll bet you that a lot of these societies, particularly in the Caribbean and Brazil is probably one of the more important. In Brazil, they still call pepper malagueta after the coast of West Africa. They still call it a malagueta pepper.
I wonder, this is always a thing that always hit me about food, and I want to talk about, when we come back from this break, reclaiming our food heritage in America and how we do that and launching that conversation with you all. But when we come out, I want to talk about, what did the world eat before the Europeans got to America? Must have been a very boring place they got here. We'll be right back. 410-319-8888. Join us as we talk the history of our food. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner. We're having another one of our Urbanite Radio stories this hour. A article written in this month's issue by Scott Carlson on the prodigal pepper. He's co-founder of the Rogers Forage Farm Initiative. He's inside our studios, along with Mick Kipp, who he features in the article because of the prodigal pepper that Mick Kipp is trying to make flourish with One Straw Farm. And he's in the studio. Alexia Savold is with us, horticulturist from the Akakik Foundation, who has brought an entire tray of these hot peppers, the seedlings of growing. And Michael Twitty is a culinary historian who studied food culture of slaves and the descendants from around this country. The number here is 410-319-8888, or write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com, 410-319-8888. I asked a question that led you to say something during the break, Scott Carlson, about, it was a semi-joke, but I mean, what did people eat before Europeans got to this hemisphere. I mean, when you think of most of the great foodstuffs, mm-hmm. from peppers to corn to potatoes and dozens of other things we can think about, came from here.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, a lot of great foods were discovered once they reached America. I mean, it was a promised land, a Garden of Eden in a lot of ways. What's frightening, I think, is that you had this flourishing of different food types and different food varieties. And what we've had in the past century, to some extent, now we have more food than we ever had before, but to some extent we have this winnowing, once again, of food varieties. I mentioned at the beginning of the hour, 7,000 apple varieties in 1900. Now we have 1,000. And the way that people understand a potato merely as a box of French fries and not really as a potato. Now, what's great about sort of the heirloom food movement is that we're not only preserving this genetic diversity, but through the work of chefs and other people who are once again sort of hooking into this romantic attachment to these different kinds of foods and the novelties of these different kinds of foods, it's causing some of these different kinds of foods to flourish. I mean, much the way that Mick is trying to revive mm-hmm. the fish pepper. It brings something unique to a culinary world, in a world in which, you can get McDonald's on every corner, you can get Taco Bell anywhere,
And so when you talk about kind of creating this kind of diverse food culture for us and what that means, I'm curious. I mean, Alexia, talk for a minute about what goes on in Akakik and this growing and saving and finding these heirloom foods of America.
Well,
or of our region anyway.
In the main garden where I work, it's called the Museum Garden, and it's a demonstration garden. It's divided into three continents. There's crops from Europe, crops from America, and crops from Africa. And it's just a great demonstration. We get a lot of school groups in just to see where certain foods come from. In Europe right now, it's going strong. There's onions, there's cabbage, kale, peas, potatoes, carrots, beets, that sort of thing. And this is their time to grow. And I haven't put in America or Africa yet because they like it a little warmer. But in America, it's going to be corn, beans, squash, tobacco, hot peppers, bell peppers, and that sort of thing. And then in Africa, I can even wait until June to put that in. And that's, millet, yams. So it's like the three sisters, but Africanized. Mm-hmm. So it's millet is the tall corn-like substitute, and then I do black-eyed peas that climb up it, and then mm-hmm. yams that travel along the ground.
Has anybody ever made the three sisters? My friend Karma, who owns Karma's Cafe, and she said you should try this. She does it. She's mm-hmm. she's one who told me about it first, which is growing squash, beans, and corn as yeah. one crop. You've tried that, have you?
Last year, Michael I did Twitty. A similar garden for Montgomery County's Historical Society at the Bell Dawson House, which actually was basically an urban plantation. 60-some enslaved people worked there, I believe. For 40-some. It's a big number for a city. But we actually did, three sisters for the corn, beans, and squash. But as Alexia said, you can do sweet potatoes, cow peas or black-eyed peas, and some tall grain, sorghum, millet.
Together.
Or watermelon as well. Anything that will cover the ground. So, same principle. Gourd, legume, tall grass. And in uh-huh. rotation, they help each other. So there's a couple things here that I want to respond to. One thing that Scott said about, chefs taking on greater, diversity in the kitchen. I mean, the American culinary world was so used to saying, oh, look at this wonderful olive oil from Provence. Well, guess what? We have our own diversity here. We have our own resources here. We have not taken use of. And those, if there wasn't a Mick, and other people who are producing sauces from these heirloom antique peppers, you got to use it if you don't want to lose it. If you don't do that, you're going to lose it. You're also losing the food culture that people have. One thing I would, kind of caution you is that most of these, once these wonderful, powerful foods, superfoods from the Americas come from Central and Latin, Central America, South America, Latin America basically today, not from North America. People here had a very stark diet compared to their cousins in Mexico. Let's just put it that way. But there's another aspect to it. We cultivate these heirlooms, but we also try to remind people that there are also thousands upon thousands of wild foods people relied upon.
Right.
The beauty of the potato and the chili pepper and the so on from Central and South America was that they were basically mass-producible vegetables. Everybody around the world had a root vegetable they relied upon. In Europe, it was the turnip. In West Africa, it was called, they call Hassa potatoes. Everybody had that, but they didn't have a potato that could grow
right
forever.
But one of the things I found interesting, though, and I want to ask Mickey a question, is that in the Native American culture, what they've been discovering is that in the original predecessors to what people call powwows today, which are more like that were created more in the 1890s, but in the from the 1500s on, there were people from native cultures from Mexico to Canada that would gather together to trade, so that these hot peppers actually made their way into America, traded for other things, and so the, there was these food things were going on in America. These cultures coming together and saying, "Oh, there's no violence here this time. We're here to trade, dance, and gamble," and so it's interesting that that's becoming to the fore about how much trading was going on before the Europeans ever got here. Between cultures in this continent of ours. And Mick, now you're stuck with the peppers. Many people may not know about Whiskey Island. I think I need to get you to kind of tell people more about the work you do.
Well, Whiskey Island is a specialty foods business. It started out making hot sauce.
You were in Hamden. You had that little thing in Hamden.
That's right. And started out making hot sauces, and then it progressed into other foods that use the pepper. Because the pepper is more than just something that you use in a hot sauce. There's so many flavors and sweetness and hotness and textures that they can be used in all kinds of food. And a company like Tabasco was really the first company to take the pepper. Who William McKelney is a Marylander. He's from Hagerstown, which is great. He took the pepper and showed that it wasn't something that the average person just kind of, I'm not going to chop that up. He made it into a sauce that now is used all around the world. William McKinney and his family that followed after that of adventures and explorers in the family were kind of like modern-day Marco Polos. They would find food elsewhere and then bring it back to where they were from. Like in Europe, in case Marco Polo, bringing spaghetti back from China to Italy. He would do that with peppers, bringing peppers to this country as far as Tabasco peppers grow, and growing them and then taking that pepper and promoting it and around the world in a sauce form. And I think I just lost my train of thought, and I apologize for that.
That's right.
But what Whiskey Island does is take these peppers that we have been able to find and create unique sauces that would be international, but now kind of have a uniqueness to Maryland, especially with the fish pepper. And after the information that Scott gave and the information, I wish I would have met or had the opportunity to get information from Lexia a year ago, knowing that with the fish pepper, you can't grow it next to a jalapeno because they might pollinate. and we found that out last year because the 1,300 seeds that we harvested, the first 200 only sprouted 3 seedlings this year, which means they became sterile because of the possibility of cross-pollination. Is that correct, or how they jump with the jalapeno? Would that possibly be the explanation?
I don't know about them being sterile from that. You might have just had a mutation. A jalapeno fish pepper. But, I don't know why they didn't all germinate.
Right, or an immature pepper that we harvested the seeds from also, which could have been. And these are things that that's why this project's like a 2 to 5 year project. See, if we can grow them massively to do something with them on a mass scale. And when I say a mass scale, I'm not saying internationally. I'm saying regionally. Let's try to bring this back to where the region has lost something. Let's see if we can bring it back to prominence in this region. It doesn't have to go elsewhere from there.
No, I mean, the thing that was fascinating about this book that Justin gave to me that came from you, Scott, which is that renewing America's food tradition, saving and savoring the continent's most endangered foods, and divides America up into these numerous food nations, is that it's like part of what we're talking about here is a birth of a movement to try to figure out how to recreate the foods that were natural to us that are not mass-produced, that we can grow like they were grown not that long ago. We're talking about our grandparents growing these foods or buying these foods. I don't know what is with this chair today, but if it falls out one more time, there we go. I'm sorry about that, folks. This chair keeps collapsing on me. That it was our grandparents either bought them and went to the market, so they or grew them. I mean, so it's not that long ago this was happening. So I'm curious about how you think that rebirth takes place in the midst of this incredible industrialization of our food, whether it's the industrialization of our poultry on the Eastern Shore, the pigs in North Carolina, or whatever. Like where we live, it's like everywhere you turn, there's corn, but all this corn is being used for industrial purposes mm-hmm. when these could be farmlands growing other things. But there's sort of two questions. How do you get that going? And B, can farmers actually make a living doing it is the problem.
Well, I think part of it happens through the novelty of the foods. I mean, Alexia, before we got into the studio here, was talking about the fact that she's growing purple carrots this year. So mm-hmm.
Purple carrots?
Yeah, so it's a different variety. It's not
they taste
one
different?
That you see.
I'm sorry?
No, I haven't tasted them yet. They're called dragon.
I want to try that.
They're purple with the orange core.
Maybe they're hot peppers. Maybe they're hot carrots. Yeah. if they're called dragons.
See, already our interest is piqued in this. We want to taste that carrot right away. I mean, we've tasted carrots a million times, you know. So, I mean, that kind of novelty is part of the way that we bring some of these foods back. I think Michael could talk about this a little bit, too. There's something about sort of the ancestral connection to some of these foods. I think particularly in the American Indian community where – you've subsisted on some of these foods for so long that it's really most healthful to eat mm-hmm. these kinds of foods.
Well, I mean, you think about the fact that if you think about eating corn, beans, and squash, and that's it, maybe pumpkins, maybe sunflowers, maybe, you know, a couple other things, but that's it. How do you make that interesting? You grow 20 varieties of each thing. That's how. And they all have different tastes, different flavors, and if you are very focused, you can distinguish between those tastes and flavors. Look at all these communities, African American, Polynesian, Native American. What do they have in common? You have a traditional way of life where you don't eat a whole lot because you don't have a lot to eat to begin with. Your body changes with the seasons, with what's available. You know, when John Smith and his ilk came over to Virginia, one thing they noticed was during the wintertime, Native Americans shrank their stomachs. They trained themselves to eat less. Their stomachs would shrink. You know, the same kind of principle behind the lap band or gastric bypass surgery. So they wouldn't be so hungry come, you know, in the wintertime when there was really nothing to eat. You know, you had to really portion out your food. Meanwhile, over behind James Fort, what's happening? These guys are starving because they're used to eating tons of food every day, and they're not having it. They're getting sick of dying like flies. Meanwhile, you know, Pocahontas is chilling, you know, because she knows not to expect anything in the middle of January, for God's sakes. But you know, I mean, you know, are you for real? I mean, there's no giant down the street. It's like that snowstorm that happened, you know. The best thing about the snowstorm was the fact that you had reporters showing up at the grocery store at 4 o'clock in the morning to cover a grocery store with full of people with no food. That was incredibly exciting. But, I mean, the Navajo, I mean, they're experiencing this horrible, you know, increase in diabetes, heart disease, cancers, things that were not there 200 years ago, things that were not there. African Americans, hypertension, cancer, diabetes.
All right.
Things that weren't there. The Polynesian community, things that weren't there.
Because they weren't eating fry bread in the case of
exactly.
the Indians.
Which you know, the first thing every Native American tells you about is fry bread.
Well, fry bread is that food that came, it was reservation food.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
People were given flour and oil.
And lard.
And lard. And this is your food now. Yes. You can't go hunt, you can't gather, you can't grow. Here's your fry bread. And fry bread's become a staple of the nation, just like the fried foods in the black world. It's become the same kind of death food.
Yeah, that's the truth. You know, it's, well, I mean, in our community, we did have a lot of oils that we fried things, but there was a difference. You worked 16 hours a day physical labor.
Right.
You know, every bit of salt and fat that went into your diet got used by your body or expressed. You know, you can't do that behind a counter. You can't do that in a veal pen station like cubicle in an office. You can't do that. So you have to keep up with it some kind of way and be physical about it.
So I'm just looking at this book as we're talking, and this broken crab and choppy okra stew looks pretty good.
Uh-huh. You've come on to something interesting. You know, in Charleston, South Carolina, they're growing that kind of okra. I'll tell you what they're doing there. I'm working with the project with them, you know, just starting to work with them. David Shields and some other people in that region. As you said earlier, I work with plantations, living history museums across the former slaveholding states. And near Charleston in Magnolia Plantation, we're actually doing enslaved people's gardens. But here's the deal. Much like Alexia does a garden that's more Chesapeake-focused, Potomac-focused, they're doing things that are more Lowcountry-focused. So there are certain types of okra, like the Chopi okra, that's endemic. I don't say indigenous, endemic to the region. And certain kinds of sweet potatoes that are endemic. Sesame. I mean, they've even found a variety of sesame, not sesame indicum, but another kind of sesame, that is from, it's brown, it's from Mende land in Sierra Leone. This was the kind of sesame they would have had, that they would have grown in that part of South Carolina.
So the question I have, this is a great book. I'm looking now, something else looks mouthwatering. Creole Stew with Gulf Coast Native Lamb. Sounds good to me. The question is, though, I mean, how do we – is this just a movement of people who have historical interest, as y'all, or is this a movement of the elite who can afford expensive foods because they're grown in heirlooms? So, I mean, that's where it seems in some ways to live at the moment. And I mean, things always bubble from the bottom. So this is kind of a bubbling from the bottom in some sense. But to make this – I mean, A, talk about what you think is the importance of this kind of food as a staple as opposed to a luxury, A, and B, how you think we get there.
Everybody taking responsibility for themselves, creating their own gardens. I mean, when the pilgrims came here, each house, each plot had its own garden, which sustained that household. And I'm not going to say it's out of laziness. I'm going from my take. I'm the worst gardener in the world. I kill more things than I can actually grow. But you have to take the time to learn and take the time to figure out what grows in your soil, what doesn't grow in your soil, and then not to plant your stuff so close together or that your roots maybe entangle and strangle out your carrots or whatever. It comes from an educational process and a want to do that. And the fact that we all need to be sustainable in our own sense individually so that we can be sustainable almost as a country, if not as a world. And until we get back into that thought process, it's an uphill battle, but I think it's definitely happening. And fortunately for even the mass stuff like the Food Network, food has just become like celebrity superstar status. Because of that network, it's taken things in some directions that are bad, but in other directions it's helped promote stuff like this. And now the History Channel with the history of foods, allowing people to see, wow, I want to do it. And it's the whole interest and want to, if you have a garden, to plant something different and to just even start a garden in your yard.
Scott? This is something that we're discovering through that Rogers Forge Farm Initiative that I'm part of, talking to the neighbors and telling them things that, to us more experienced gardeners, we just sort of know, you know, the plant spacing in certain ways. The other, you know, a couple of weeks ago, one of my neighbors, I helped her plant up lettuce this spring, and she asked me, how do I pick it? I have no idea how to pick it. So it's this process of re-educating ourselves in these things that were understood for a long time. All of this with the heirlooms and with this kind of growing of these unique types of foods, it has to happen in the gardens. It has to happen on these small scales because with a lot of these heirloom plants, they're just too finicky, too difficult to be produced in sort of mass ways. Mm-hmm. You're not going to have sort of large-scale farming come in and save some of these heirloom vegetables because they can't use them.
Why can't they use them? I mean, if you're growing, I don't see why you couldn't take an acre of land and grow thousands of tomatoes of any variety.
You can, but agriculture today is grown for the plants that they grow in agriculture today are grown for a couple of different reasons. They can be shipped long distances. They have long shelf life. They look pretty on the shelf. They have some sorts of industrial attributes to them that allow them to be processed in these mass-produced ways. We grew black crim tomatoes last year, this very dark purple tomato, in our front yards. And what I found about that tomato was that it was very thin-skinned. A lot of them broke right on the plant. And once they break on the plant, you know, you have to you have to pick them or they're going
eat
to
them
rot
be done
right
with
away.
It.
Right. That'll never happen in an industrial environment.
So tell me, if Alexia, I mean, in terms of the work you do, why do you do it? I mean, is this being done to give people a chance to see what was, or is there something else in mind here?
Yes. It's historical reasons, and also just we also teach gardening classes and, you know, just show people that you can do it, you know, on a small scale. We also have an 8-acre organic vegetable farm, but my museum garden is just an eighth of an acre, so it's manageable. It's doable. Anyone can do it. You don't need, you know, tractors or anything. Just be able to feed yourself.
Michael Twitty, I mean, did you think there's a future in this for the rest of the world, or this is, again, something that is just something to interest folks who are interested in this in heirloom varieties of food?
You know, long before when I was growing up, we always had a garden. This was not quaint. This was my grandparents, all of whom were Southern migrants, who said, you know, I want this, I want that, I want fresh greens, I want, you know, things I can control and, you know, decide big choices about what I want to grow. I didn't grow up with a single grandparent that didn't have a garden. So to me, it came naturally. And they didn't matter if they were in the city. I mean, if you go anywhere, you know, some parts of D.C., you'll notice that in the Adams Morgan, Columbia Heights, Latino community will make, what's the word for the little plots? I forget the name, where they grow corn and peppers and things in little tree islands. Every space, the front yard, okra growing in the front yard near Howard University. So, I mean, that tells you something. But, I mean, the bottom line is you have to have a taste for it, a desire for it. I mean, people are sort of proclaiming those tomatoes don't taste right. Well, I wonder why. They begin to ask the question. It's slow but sure. It's slowly but surely work. I mean, the seeds don't cost that much.
Well, the modern tomato just tastes like nothing anyway.
You can probably. I'm sorry, that's right.
It's got no taste.
But you can buy. You can make your own heirloom tomato garden using pots that you put on a deck, using cheap, you know, fairly cheap seeds, as many as you want, and some of them, like the Cherokee Purple, I like to grow, you know, more tomatoes than you can ask for.
I wish we had a great tomorrow. This is a fascinating here. Michael Twitty, culinary historian, wonderful to meet you. Ed Last, good to have you in the studio. Alexia Sybil, lovely to meet you for your work you do. Good to see you again, Scott Carlson, and good to see you again, Mick Kipp.
That's
Whiskey
smart.
Island. Check out those things. They're really good. And we'll have information about all of our guests and what they do and where you can contact them and their work on our website. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite. This month, Urbanite explores the city's contemporary art scene and the prospects for leveraging this cultural energy into a force for a broader community change. Urbanite is available at over 800 locations. Visit www.urbanitebaltimore.com for a complete list of pickup locations. And this today was an Urbanite radio story. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Justin Levy and Christina Arison. We're engineered by Brian Boone. Our interns are Richard Good and Felicia Faison. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, hear new additional interviews, and find out information about our guests and their work, visit us on the web at steinershow.org. For Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.